The light is on. There you go. It's wonderful to be here. I've had it on my appointment calendar for a long time. The union set up the actual appointment, and I trust them because I know that they will send me where liberty is appreciated, and I can already tell that is the case. Sitting in on the Sabbath school class, I thought they're either listening to the program that I have on 3ABN or reading Liberty Magazine or LinkedIn somewhere, because these people know all the particulars about current events and our logic of religious liberty. And it is a privilege for me to be here. I appreciated the introduction. I speak at a lot of big black churches, and they can give you such an introduction, you feel a little ashamed to get up and speak after that. This was a very good contraction and summary of some things. I should clarify a few things. I came from Australia as a teenager when my father transferred back in the 60s to the General Conference, and I went to Tacoma Academy right down the street from the General Conference, and it was an interesting class. Ted Wilson was in my same class, so I've told him on a number of occasions that we're children of the church. Literally, it's very true. I went back to Australia for 9 years after I was married, but still, if you go on some of the basics I've given you, you'll see that I've mostly lived in this country, but my tongue will betray me. Can't help that, I'm sorry. Liberty Magazine, though, has a great history, and it was referred to in the introduction. You know, it's 105, 106 years since Liberty was begun, and I've spent a lot of time since I became editor going back and looking at the history, not just of Religious Liberty, Liberty Magazine, but of our Religious Liberty program. And you know, we had a magazine before Liberty. There was the Sentinel of Liberty. And the editor of that was Alonzo T. Jones. I must admit, in the years before I became editor, I mostly heard A.T. Jones in a very contentious way. Because when I was book editor of Pacific Press, and then even in Australia, working at our publishing house, I'd get people come at me with a burden that they had, that I must understand something about A.T. Jones's 1888 message. And it amazed me that people that I thought were left-wing and people that I thought were right-wing seemed to be united in their burden that there was some secret message, some code to be discovered in what A.T. Jones said in 1888. And I've come to believe there was no secret code, but there was a very big truth having to do with 1888. And now that I'm editing Liberty Magazine, I'm convinced that our religious liberty work, as it was back in those 1880s, should be central to what Seventh-day Adventists are on about today. I've been very gratified that Elder Ted Wilson, after his election in Atlanta, very quickly started calling for revival. Because in my view, that's what's needed. People were talking in the Sabbath school class that I sat in on about signs of Sunday law, signs of the resurgence of the papacy, all of the signs, the great controversy in particular, enumerates from a biblical basis that the Lord's coming is near. You know, that's been true all my life, most of your lives, I'm sure. You know, the Cold War was nothing if but the suspended sword of Damocles of man's self-destruction. We're lucky that we're still here. It's only God's forbearance. And I've come to the conclusion that it would have finished long before this, except that God is waiting for something. And Alonzo T. Jones became absolutely convinced of that in his time. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about it this afternoon, if you're willing to come back to that. But if you look back in the simple sense of the story, in 1888, A.T. Jones and some of the others in the church were battling an incipient Sunday law in the United States. I know Adventists are very much, I'm trying to think of, I was going to make up a word about, you know, they've got a single-minded view on Sunday laws. There's a little bit more to the end of time than Sunday laws, but we do believe that the great test over loyalty to God or a false system will be over a day of worship and a false day, Sunday, versus the true day, the Saturday. And in A.T. Jones' time, this country was on the verge of enacting an overt Sunday law, not a blue law. They exist all over the place. Still about 20 states have blue laws that restrict your activity on Sunday from an underlying understanding or a presumption that Sunday is a semi-sacred day and you shouldn't do all the regular things. But this law, back in 1888, was designed to shut the country down so that people could go and worship. And you can read the legislation. It's in different places online, different sites. And I read it recently, and I was quite shocked. It made no bones about its religious intention. And A.T. Jones fought that with other people, not just Adventists, and it was defeated. He appeared before a congressional committee, at least on one occasion, gave a good testimony, and it was defeated. But as he was fighting that, something suddenly hit him. He saw that we were about to face that final test. And he looked at his church, which back then was 25,000 Seventh Adventists. Little group. He looked at his church. He recognized, if you read the story of A.T. Jones, that he was in a personal war with the president and the secretary. They did not like him because he was Ellen White's fair-haired boy. They complained in letters, even in something we recently reprinted from the White Estate, Spirit of Prophecy Councils Relating to Church-State Relationships. There's letters there where they complained to Ellen White. They said, you always back A.T. Jones. They didn't like his upstart status. He was a young guy that had come out of the military, lived in Ellen White's home for a while, and just absolutely bought into the religious liberty work. They opposed him right up through 1888 and beyond. And he looked at his membership, and he saw abundantly clearly that they were not ready. They were not spiritually on fire. And he heard what Ellen White was saying. He read what it said in the Bible about a refreshing before the Lord's return. And so he began preaching for revival. And my point, this isn't really my sermon, I'm sorry, but I won't try to talk too long. My point is that today we are in that same dynamic. And I think it's providential that our leadership, starting with our relatively recently elected president, is calling for revival. You know, we'll have a meeting this afternoon. I can go as many hours as you want and give you reasons that things are coming together, reasons for the decline of Protestantism in this country, reasons for the rise of the Catholic Church, reasons for the rapid approach of what will probably soon become a Sunday law. Reasons for all of these things. But the real dynamic is, in my view, is the need for revival. Once the revival comes, I believe it will happen like that. In fact, when I look back in my experience, and I grew up in the church, I'm a fourth generation Seventh Adventist. I believe that over and over again, God has given us moments right on the edge. And if we'd responded correctly, I shouldn't say correctly. It's not a matter of correctly or incorrectly, but if we had responded fully, things would have happened. Ellen White said many times that the Lord was supposed to come before this. I remember once in Australia I was preaching, and when I came down from the pulpit, you know, one fellow grabbed me and he said, that's sacrilegious what you've said. Like we can determine when Christ comes. I mean, that's exactly what Ellen White said. You know, the time is set by God's foreknowledge, but it's not predetermined. And Jesus himself in his earthly ministry said, only the Father in heaven knows. He didn't even know, which explains fully. While on this earth, he spoke about the possible dynamic, and he said, there's some people here who won't see death. Ellen White said the same thing. C.S. Lewis said once, talking about that, he says he'd rather believe in a God that didn't know than a God that was wrong. And certainly Jesus had given away elements of his divinity, as the construct of appearing here on earth. But he knew the dynamic. If his people respond, then the conditions will be fulfilled and he will come in glory. That's as true today as it ever was. And so when I talk about religious liberty this morning and this afternoon, I please want you to see it in that dynamic. I deal with a lot of lawyers, many of them working in our system, and I had opinions even before coming into this job, and one of the greatest dangers of our religious liberty discussion in America, the United States particularly, is that we treat it as a legal construct and a constitutional issue, which we legitimately discuss, but at root it is a spiritual thing. At root it is divine. At root its model is God's. It is not man's. And our point of reference needs to be the liberty that God gives us, not that man can give or acknowledge. You know, the Constitution was very appropriate in saying that, you know, these are God-given. It didn't create them or give them to us. It recognized them. But it is possible as Americans, United States citizens, living in this blessed country, it's not uniformly blessed, but overall, we've been shielded from much of what the world's population lives through. But it's possible that because of that, we'll be blinded to developments even here and not see prophecy fulfilling. A few months ago, if you were listening, and I'm sure you got the notice, the General Conference sent out a word that churches all around the world were to pray for Pastor Montero, Antonio Montero, Seventh Adventist pastor, a Sabbath school director in the country of Togo. He's been in prison now for 1 year. And we all prayed for him. And it's ironic that in a way we prayed because we found that we couldn't do anything. We shouldn't really wait till it's to that point. But this is a very egregious situation. In this little country of Togo, where there's only about 6 million members, or 6 million citizens, rather, and of those 6 million, only about 20-25% Christian, 20-25% Muslim, and the rest animists. In that country where we have about 5,000 members, this man was arrested on one of the most heinous charges imaginable. He's actually not a citizen of Togo, he's a citizen of Cape Verde Islands, a little group of islands about 400 miles directly off that country on the west coast of Africa. Well, this is out in the ocean. And you will not believe what happened. I know our church leaders and the lawyers that shuttle across to try to connect with his case are really at a loss to know how it could even come about, because there was a huge crime in that country. About 20 young women were killed, and it appeared that their blood had been drained. And the popular press looked at it, and they were convinced that there was some sort of satanic or animist rituals associated with it. They arrested a known criminal who readily confessed, and then he said that Pastor Montero was the ringleader of this crime gang. And he was arrested, as well as another Seventh-day Adventist layman. And they've been in Lome Prison, the capital of Togo, for 1 year. And at this point, we don't know when he'll even go to trial, let alone how it will turn out. Once he was put in jail, then the local television station started running all sorts of stories about Seventh-day Adventists, how we are the type of people that will steal people's blood, kill young women, and so on. It's persecution, and yet, like so often around the world, it's not narrowly, he's not narrowly speaking in jail because he's a Seventh-day Adventist. It may be that because a Seventh-day Adventist in a distinctly non-Christian environment, representing a church that has the aura of, as it should, because it's a North American-based church, of being a foreign influence, that he was under such suspicion that there was an inclination to accuse him without any evidence. We don't know. Very often, that is how persecution is. Your religious status means that you're vulnerable to charges of all natures, that everything from your tax returns to your employment is subject to review and negative attitudes. He's in a prison there where they're not very good. If you read Liberty Magazine, you'll know that I've had a concern about prisons in the United States. And I'm quite certain that when a Sunday law comes And when Seventh-day Adventists are put in prison for religious reasons, we will suddenly discover how important prisons are, because you lose most of your rights in a prison, as you'd expect. You go into an environment where people can physically and mentally victimize and abuse you, and the guards and the authorities that send you there can decide where to send you, how to treat you, and can in essence deliver you up to extra special punishment. But at least we have guards, at least we have some sort of way of controlling prisons here. But in a country like Togo, they have a prison building. They open the door, they throw you inside, and they lock the door, and the guards guard the periphery. Because inside, the prisoners administer it, they take the food in the door, and they feed themselves, they govern themselves, and they throw the dead out periodically. That's where Pastor Montero has been for a year. He's of good faith. But we need to pray for him and people like him. And it's a danger that as Seventh-day Adventists, told to pray for this one man, we will forget that all around the world, hundreds of thousands of people, mostly Christians, are being persecuted for their faith. Many Seventh-day Adventists. I can remember years ago when my father was heading up the temperance department. He went to Bulgaria several times as a guest of the government, which temperance and religious liberty, we have a different sort of a way of contacting authorities. It's not usually with other churches. And so he was able to go in as a guest of the government. And on one of his visits, he followed a little after some of the top leaders from the General Conference who had visited the church. And he discovered that seven of our pastors were suddenly in jail, been imprisoned, along with several other lay people. And he talked to the communist leaders and he said, "Why are these people in jail?" And they said, "Why, your own leaders, your own people have said that these were dissidents, that they were not Seventh-day Adventists." Because what had happened within the church there was a problem, as there always was in communist countries, about young people going to church on Sabbath or, as required by the government, going to school. And many people would not send their children to school. And within the church, those that wanted to be accepted by the government, not harassed, not singled out for special treatment, often would turn on these fanatics, conservatives, and they would disfellowship. And I remember my father telling us how it was his privilege, talking to these government leaders, to say to them, "Release them at once, or I will go around the world saying that this is not a free country." And they did. They released them like that. But as I've told that story a few times, and I've listened to what goes on in this country and visited many other countries, it strikes me that in any context people are living, they listen to each other. And while there's Twitter and the internet and news more from other countries than there used to be, most people are in their own social bubble. And I don't care what country it is, unless it's a country in the midst of a gross civil war like Syria, or places where people have religious or political differences with the country. Within any context, most people listen to each other, and they always say they live in the freest country in the world. I mean, you think that's crazy, because you think you live in the freest country. And you may. But you don't live in the freest country just because your peers tell you so. And it's very important, as we come to a period when we can expect religious persecution, both within and without the church, we need to have our point of reference very plainly thought out. And I do believe that in the United States, we're going to have the greatest possible deception, because our automatic assumption will be that this is a free country, and that even in times of stress, our government and those in authority, they wish us only the best, and we can sort of ride this out. Man's ways are nearly always in opposition to God, and we're told in Revelation 13 that even here a lamb-like beast will move against God's people. I've thought about, though, this persecution of Seventh-day Adventists and others around the world. It's happening now. You know, in the Sabbath school class, people were talking about when things might happen. One more crisis would bring it. And that's true. I can remember after 9/11 with James Standish, who's now back in Australia, but he was one of the associates at the General Conference for Religious Liberty, and he was our legislative liaison to Congress. He and I were down at George Washington University at one of the television programs they did. I think it was Firing Line or something like that. And we were waiting for them to begin, and while they were prepping, they were showing a video feed on the big screen behind the set, and suddenly it broke into a news flash that the power was down on the whole eastern seaboard, and it was coming toward Washington, but New York and so on, the power had dropped, and the assumption was that it was a terrorist attack. And I can remember James and I looked at each other, this is it. Because we thought then, and I still think now, that a similar event like 9/11, next time we'll be under martial law and all sorts of things will come. But in other parts of the world, they're already into their apocalypse. The Pew Forum recently did a survey around the world, and they pointed out that 70% of the world's population live under extreme restrictions on religious freedom. 70%. And persecution is rife. The story of the Arab Spring, while people now are a little bit disillusioned, they thought it was great to start with, but they still don't understand what's really going on. The Arab Spring is nothing but the final expulsion of Christians from the Middle East. Millions of Christians are fleeing for their lives in countries where they once were the majority. In Egypt, you know, that was a Christian country before Islam took over. In Iraq, there were 1 to 2 million Christians before the invasion. There are 200,000 left now. The rest are either dead or have fled. Persecution is a broad-based thing. And Adventists are many of those that are being persecuted. Also Roman Catholics. That's one of the reasons. And I'll talk about it this afternoon, that there is a newfound interest in religious liberty in the Roman Catholic Church. It's not artificial. They have a real concern. Unfortunately, their real concern as they gain dominance may revert to their medieval mindset. That's another question. Years ago in Liberty Magazine, and through the promotion we sent out, as we do every year, and I'm presuming in January you had a promotion here, but years ago we sent out material on the case of another Adventist who was imprisoned for his life, Pastor Anthony Alexander. I don't know how many of you remember that. But it impressed me mightily, because as with Pastor Montero, Pastor Anthony Alexander, who was a pastor and a teacher for us, our church, in Sri Lanka, a little country I once grew up knowing as Ceylon, off the east coast of India. But that country was in the middle of a severe civil war that continued right through till I think it was 2009, where hundreds of thousands of people were being killed as two factions, ethnic and religious, Buddhists and Hindus, fought for dominance of the country. And Pastor Alexander was the minority Tamils. And on a fateful occasion, one of his students came, or a new student came to the school, to the Adventist school. Pastor Alexander befriended him, and the government then said, he is a Tamil tiger gorilla, and by befriending him, you show you support the Tamil tigers, and you will be on trial for your life. And he was arrested, put on trial on terrorism charges. This was just a bit before 9/11. And I can remember again, as with Pastor Montero, the lawyers shuttling from the General Conference backwards and forwards, and they would come back every time, gray faces, because they'd sat in on the courtroom, and they said he'll be lucky to escape with his life. He'll be lucky if he gets life imprisonment. But the penalty was execution. And amazingly and providentially, after again we prayed for him many times, he was suddenly released, spirited to Canada, and he's been working there as a pastor ever since. For the story that we did in Liberty, though, I sat down with Pastor Alexander and interviewed him, and it taught me a few things. I certainly had great respect for for his personal faithfulness and what he endured, because he told me that in the 2 years that he was in prison, they regularly would bring him in for interrogations where they would tie his ankles together, put a pole between the through his legs and underneath the rope, and hang him upside down and beat on the soles of his feet to cause pain and injury, but no marks. Then they would also bring him in, put a book or two on his head, and then beat on his head for hours to cause brain injury, headaches, memory loss, but no visible damage. These were horrible things. But then he told me, he said, he believed that it was the Lord's will that he be put in prison. Now, that's not the way we brought up a Seventh-day Adventist. I can remember in Australia as a kid praying with the rest of the world church that our members in Colombia would be relieved because the Catholic Church working on the government there was persecuting them. We prayed that God would back things off, help them, release them. And I don't think that was a bad prayer. I just believe it was a misdirected prayer. God's not in the business of making life easy for us. It's promised. Jesus made a promise. He says, all who live a godly life will suffer persecution. If you're living a godly life, Satan will come after you one way or another, either by the government or your neighbors or maybe even your pew member, your pew mate in the church. It's a mark for Satan. All who live godly lives will suffer persecution. And Pastor Alexander said that it was God's will that he be imprisoned. And he told me the story about how he was put in jail for 2 years. And in jail, there were Buddhists, there were Hindus, there were Muslims, there were some Christians. And he was able to witness to these men. And by the time of his release, he was meeting every Sabbath with a group of 60 prisoners. He'd formed a church. That's why he didn't want to be released when the moment came. And that's why, as he recounted the story to me, God made sure that it was taken care of, because just before his release, another pastor was imprisoned and he was able to continue the pastoring of that church group. That put a little bit different light on it for me. I mean, please don't get me wrong. Not in my wildest dreams would I ever want to have trouble. What human except a masochist, someone who's so fanatical that they've lost sight of all reality, would purposely want trouble? But anybody who's wanting to witness for their Lord would welcome a challenge when it comes, whether it's prison, whether it's a direct challenge with the authorities or whatever. If God is able to be glorified by that, that's what it must be. And actually, in many countries around the world, the time of persecution is the time when their message came to the fore. I wouldn't presume to comment on here. In fact, I think you're very well known next to a shopping mall. But I can tell you, I've been to churches before GPS where I'd have to sometimes ask directions and stop along. I remember in Canada once, I stopped maybe 20 times along a long street where our church was on, because the numbers were confusing, asking, is there an Adventist church here? And the last question was three doors away, and they were quite adamant, there's no Adventist church here. But when you're brought before a prince, when you're brought before a judge, when you're brought before the authorities, when you're on local television for your faith, when you're before the employer or the union is challenging you, all of these things guarantee that your story will be told. And if your life is in accordance with that, if you're living up to your claim, then there is a powerful witness that I think God has used and will use. And that's what it's all about. That's what A.T. Jones was encouraging. If God's people are revived and empowered, then they don't pray that the Sunday law goes away. They don't want it. They would hold it off Well, I can't remember the text, but the evil day, we don't want the evil day to come, but we're delaying it because it will give more opportunity for witness and evangelism. Of course, that part of the dynamic causes us to push back against it, but it's the opportunity for witness that is so powerful for us. We had a Bible reading a little bit earlier from Daniel, And I'm hardly telling you a story that you're ignorant of, but I really want to bring up Daniel now, because Daniel is one of those powerful stories that should inspire us. When I was a young fellow, like many young people, I used to sing that song, you know, dare to be a Daniel, dare to stand alone, standing by a purpose true. You know, it's powerful. It was very inspiring to me as a young person. And you know, I'm not as young as I used to be, but I still remember what it's like to be a young person, and we hardly use it. A young person is idealistic. They have illusions often, but aspirations to do great things for a great cause. And we shouldn't encourage them to think that we can get rid of all of these troubles. You know, in fact, it's a poem, it's Shakespeare. Shakespeare in one of his plays, you know, said that we should take sail against a sea of troubles. You know, if we've got a good captain, that's a great thing to do. That's an adventure that any young person, anyone with a young faith, would welcome. And Daniel took a sail into a great adventure when he was just a young person. He was taken captive by King Nebuchadnezzar from his homeland, taken there, and I remember when it was explained to me once, I was a little bit shocked, but the indications are he was taken, yes, into the king's palace, but he was taken there first as a hostage and second as a eunuch. He was made into a neutered servant of the king, and he was trained in the king's service. Remember, Arioch in charge of the eunuchs was the one in charge of him. And he was faithful at every point, over diet. He was faithful over worship. He was faithful over witnessing to the king about the dream. And you come to Daniel chapter 6, where I want to make a point. And by that point, actually, in Daniel chapter 5, Daniel's already an old man, probably in his 80s. And there's that transitional scene there where on the last night of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar's dynasty, his son, grandson, it's not real clear his relationship to his father, Nebuchadnezzar, but there Belshazzar, cavorting and partying there with the palace retinue while outside the invading army is milling around ready to come under the walls in a dried up river. But Belshazzar was throwing all caution to the winds. He even brought in the temple vessels that they'd taken from Jerusalem, profaned them, and then the hand came on the wall. And remember, Daniel was called in, an 80-year-old man, and asked to say what that was. And he says, "Weighed, found wanting. Your kingdom is taken from you." And it says, that night, Belshazzar was slain. But before he was slain, he made Daniel the third man in the kingdom. And, you know, how often do you see something like that where there was a total change of regime, not just an election, you know, violence, another regime violently replaced the previous one. And the first verses of chapter 6 says, it pleased Darius the Mede, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three presidents, of whom Daniel was one. And it says, then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. That's the backdrop for the point that I want to make. And, you know, in many ways, Seventh-day Adventists, I think, are the same way. We've become distinguished because of our faithfulness, our integrity, or at least when we have integrity, we become distinguished. You know, our hospitals, when they keep to the basic principles, have given a wonderful witness. Our institutions, when they've kept to our principles, have given a wonderful witness. Our public figures, you see them on TV now and then. I would not name anybody, but sometimes Seventh-day Adventists are thrown into the limelight. And when they make a clear statement, it works to the positive for the church and for God. And Daniel was rising to the top of that new kingdom. And then the plotting started. And, you know, I sometimes think of this even at the General Conference. It's a human institution, or at least a human structure, to carry forward a divine challenge. And human beings plot and plan and snipe and work in a thousand ways to undercut the Lord's plans. And we're told in Daniel that obviously it wasn't 122, the 120 satraps and the two other presidents, but a significant number of them were jealous of Daniel. They went by agreement, the term says, to the king, and they said, "King, here's a plan. You're new in this kingdom, you know, strange people, strange gods, as Tennyson said. You need to get control of them. And here's a law. Pass this law by the laws of the Medes and Persians that for 1 month, 30 days, nobody shall make any representation or worship of anybody, any god or man except you." And of course the king liked it because it was a powerful way to show, "I'm in charge now. This is a new regime." And he signed it into law, and their plot was fixed. And I want you to notice the next text after that. Verse 10 of Daniel 6 says, "When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber, open toward Jerusalem, and he got down upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously." First of all, it tells me he was not ignorant. When he knew, he was waiting for word of it. As soon as he found that it had been passed, then he did this. Prayed as he always did, and he gave thanks. It will be the most wonderful day for the Adventist witness when a Sunday law comes in this country. Do you realize that? We shouldn't want it because it's the end of what we're supposed to be doing now, proclaiming to the Lord. But we should give thanks because it's the moment for witness. And unless I've misread Ellen White greatly, there was a hint given in the Sabbath school class. She says that for Seventh-day Adventists, the Sunday law is the end of probation. For other people, it's the beginning of the period where they have the probationary period to make up their mind. It will reveal absolutely what Seventh-day Adventists are when the Sunday law comes. But this is the mobilizing moment. And look at Daniel. There was no rule that I could find, or that you and I'm sure you're the same, could ever find in the Bible that says you have to pray to God three times a day toward Jerusalem. If anything, that sounds rather Islamic to me. That was Daniel's practice. He was in exile. He was longing to go back to Jerusalem. He could pray as regularly as he needed to. But he did that before. And if he changed it after the prohibition, it would be a denial of God. And we need to understand that. I am quite sure now in my own self that when the Sunday law comes, somewhere, some way, even within our own system, there will be something, whether it's in the record or your UN paper or something, somebody will say, recognizing that our country is facing difficult times, and while Seventh-day Adventists know that the seventh day is the Sabbath, but wanting to support our nation's move toward, to acknowledging God and so on in these difficult times, we encourage Adventists not to challenge this spiritual revival in our country. There will be weaselly statements. I'm certain of it. And the only defense that you and I will have will be to remember the biblical models and the instructions of God. No compromise. We must defend God when the moment comes. We shouldn't shut the windows. We shouldn't shut the doors. We shouldn't, as I remember seeing in Laos. I mean, it'll resonate with me till the day I die. A communist regime, hardcore regime that controls everything, especially the churches. But our church is allowed to practice in Laos, in the capital of Vientiane. And we found they sang the same songs, they did all the same stuff within the church, and nobody was in prison, nobody persecuted, even though in that country, if you give out Christian literature, the government minister himself told us this, if you give out Christian literature in the villages, you will get prison time. You will get it's about 15 to 25 years. And we discovered that our people there, you know, I can't speak to their hearts, but their actions show that they have allowed, as the Bible says, the world has squeezed them into its mold. That's a TV version of Paul's statement there. I think it's in Corinthians. Because we found that outside the doors of the church, our members there buttoned their lips up, went along with Buddhist ceremonies and whatever the community was doing, kept quiet. We must be careful that, yes, we don't provoke trouble, but as the laws get tighter, as it becomes more and more dangerous, even in this country, to speak openly of what we believe, don't ever fall for the allure of keeping quiet, thinking that you will escape. In fact, even as I say that, think about Mordecai. He said that to Esther. Don't think, even in the king's palace, you will escape anymore if you keep quiet at this time. Daniel didn't keep quiet. Daniel prayed. And you know the rest of that story. The king put him in the lion's den very unwillingly, labored all night, all day to save him, prayed all night, or worried all night, and then the morning came back and Daniel answered the king's inquiry, and he says, "The Lord sent his angels and shut the lions' mouths." Tells me they were open. They weren't passive lions. They were ready to go at him, but the angels shut them. Recently I read some of Daniel, Bell and the Dragon, the apocryphal book is called. Very few Adventists are aware of these sort of books, although if you really look closely, you find that Ellen White quotes from the Apocrypha many, many times, and not all the Apocrypha are valid, but some of them speak to truth. And the Bible itself quotes apocryphal books, the Book of Enoch, for example. But Bell and the Dragon tells a couple of interesting stories. Tells about Daniel in the lion's den, although in Bell and the Dragon, he's in the lion's den for several days. It also tells the story of the name of the book, where Daniel said that Bel, this god, was nothing but a god of wood covered with metal. And the priest said, "He's profaned the gods. He should be put to death." And the king said, "Well, yes, you've done that, Daniel." He says, "But if the god can be shown to be false or just an artifact, then we'll put the priest to death. But if he's a real god, you will be put to death." And so the issue in Bel and the Dragon was, would the god take the offerings that he seemed to take every night? So they did the test. They locked the temple up after the offerings had been placed in front of the god. In the morning, they come in and the offering's gone. And they were just in the process of taking Daniel away to be executed. And he said, "Wait a minute." And he spread some dust on the floor. And then they saw the footprints of the priest coming out of the secret chamber. Who knows whether that's true, but it's certainly true to life of the trickery often that satanic forces will resort to. But it's also indicative of how bold we need to be about speaking of false systems and false gods. We can't mince words. Also in Bell and the Dragon, it says there, which is implicit in the Daniel record, that the king was concerned that the enemies of Daniel would come in after he was put in the lion's den, that they would come in and kill him. And you can see in Daniel chapter 6, it says there that the door was sealed up. Why? The lions weren't in the business of breaking seals. They didn't want anyone else taking matters into their own hands. I've thought about how we can remain faithful many times. And I don't know about you, but it's easy for me to get up and talk about it here. But, you know, I look at a lot of my life and I haven't always done what I've supposed to have done. And so I want to tell you about one life story that illustrates perhaps what we can do even with a bad start. And it also illustrates the role of Liberty Magazine. You're not so far from Idaho. It's just over a few mountains and up a little to the north. I was there for 9 years in Idaho. I came back from Australia, and I remember when I got the call to Australia, I thought, Idaho, never been there before. I'd lived on the East Coast. So what do I know about Idaho? I remember going to the National Geographic and pulling a few articles, and they all seemed to be about rodeos or deserts and tumbleweed and sagebrush, more appropriately, dust. Didn't look too good to me. I ended up loving Idaho. But one thing I already knew about Idaho, I'd read as a young person the story of Harry Orchard. Remember his story? Harry Orchard was a criminal. He was a criminal in the service of the Western Miners Federation, the Western Miners Union, back at the turn of not our last century, but the century before, right at the time that Liberty Magazine was begun, right at the time that in this country, you know, it's a great country now, but anyone knows U.S. history, we've gone through incredibly traumatic times of great social stress. And at that time, it was still the great conflict between the worker and the employer, between capital and labor. And it was a time when the Pinkertons were in full form. You know, Pinkertons, if you're lucky now and then you see them delivering or taking money out of a bank. I mean, you know, they're a security service. But back then, there were more Pinkertons than U.S. military. And they were an armed police force that were used mostly by the employers to break strikes and other things like that. And very often, there'd be a strike on, as there were several times in the Western mining area. There'd be a strike on, and they'd bring a trainload of Pinkertons in. They'd offload from the train with guns and truncheons and just wade into the miners or the strikers. And people were killed and people were harmed. Not good. It was the time when Ellen White began talking about trade unions being a problem at the very end of time. And she's quite unequivocal in what she said about trade unions. She said that someone expecting the return of Christ could not belong to any trade union that has been or will be formed. Because a trade union takes away, in a work context, your personal choice and your moral commitment to obedience to God. But that doesn't mean that on the other side everything was hunky-dory. It was a great seesaw of rights. And Harry Orchard was hired by this belligerent trade union organization to do their bidding. He blew up a mine, killing a number of people. He blew up a train station, killing more people. He tried to assassinate the governor of Colorado. That failed. He killed a political figure after trying to poison him. Then he came to the door and shot him point blank. And his final act, where he finally got caught by the law, was assassinating the recently retired Governor Stunenberg of Idaho, who had had the temerity to call out the federal troops against one of the strikes. And Harry Orchard went to the little town of Caldwell, Idaho, one of the twin towns there right near our publishing house. And it's not a big town even today, but I'm sure it was only a few thousand people back then. And he went to that town where the governor lived. He went to the hotel that the governor frequented, sat there in the public area, watched the governor socializing with someone. Then he walked out to the governor's home, rigged up a tripwire bomb on his gate, walked back, passing the governor on the way, tipping his hat to him and saying hello, and then just as he arrived back at the hotel, he heard the explosion. Well, they caught Harry Orchard. He was put on trial, and it was a trial easily as big for the United States as the O.J. Simpson trial. Clarence Darrow and other lawyers were involved. It was a huge thing. But something happened to Harry Orchard while he was in jail. He was visited by the son of the governor, as well then later by a couple of other Christians. And the governor's son came to him with a message from his mother, and he said, "We forgive you." And then he told him about what being a Seventh-day Adventist Christian meant, because they were Seventh-day Adventists. And I discovered this only a few months ago when I was down in our archives, reading a story told by a previous editor of Liberty Magazine, because the testimony is plain. They repeated it. Governor Stunenberg's wife said this. She said, "We had been receiving Liberty Magazine, and because of Liberty Magazine, we discovered the Sabbath. We discovered the Seventh-day Adventist Church." And she said the governor kept his last Sabbath on this earth. He kept as his first Sabbath observing, you know, the biblical Sabbath. Incredible. And Harry Orchard became a Seventh-day Adventist. And he never left that prison. He was only in his 30s when he was imprisoned. They expected, he expected to be executed, but they commuted it. and he was given life imprisonment, and he lived 50 years in that prison until his dying day. And the book that I read and other accounts that I've looked up are all the same, that here this man was characterized by a constant Christian witness, a sunny disposition, a friendly, kind demeanor, a man that was so corrupted by crime in his early days. When he made that commitment for Christ, even in a prison, his witness for the Lord was unblemished. And I know I could do that, I mean, with God's power, but I know I could do it because I've got not quite as bad a beginning as Harry Orchard. God's power can do it for us. And whether we're in prison because of something that we may have been a part of, and don't misunderstand me, but we don't know everything that's informed Pastor Montero's present situation. He may have been foolish enough to have had bad conversations with this man that fingered him. I don't know. He may be holy enough to have had nothing to do with it. But usually life is a little bit more complex. But I'm certain of this, that in prison, Pastor Anthony Alexander, in prison, Harry Orchard, in prison, you or me, that we can witness for God in a powerful way. And prison is a state of the mind, ultimately. And with religious liberty, nobody can take it away from you. It's not whether you are in prison. It's not whether you lose your job, which we don't want you to do. We can defend you a little with present laws. But the real issue is, as a free person under God, freed from the power of sin, you exercise your religious liberty momentarily and daily in your witness to other people. I want to conclude, since the meeting's coming up not too far away, I want to conclude by mentioning a few words from a sermon given about the same time as Liberty Magazine was begun, about the same time that Harry Orchard was caught for his crimes and then began his life anew. The Prince of Preachers, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, preaching in London, Baptist preacher, he preached a sermon on Daniel in the Lion's Den, and he says a few things that I think are pertinent to us today and in this country. He makes a statement again. Remember what I was saying about any country that you're in, that's your point of reference. He says this: "Now it is a great privilege that we enjoy civil and religious liberty in our favored land." He was talking about England. "We are not under such cruel laws that, as in other times or in other countries, laid restrictions upon consciences. We are allowed to pray according to the conviction of our judgment and the desire of our heart." He's talking about Daniel praying to the risk of his life. "But as I want you to value the privilege very much, I will put a supposition to you. Suppose there was only one place in the world where a man might pray and offer his supplications unto God." Spurgeon said, "Well, I think there's not a man among us who would not like to get there at some time or another, or at least to die there. What pains we should take to reach the locality, and what pressure we would endure to enter the edifice." And he says, "But now that prayer is free, without money and without price, and the poorest need not bring a farthing," that was the half penny, "farthing when he comes to have audience with God, oh, how prayer is neglected." And I believe he was coming at this same need. Revival, that's what's needed in rising to the challenge. He says, "Perhaps it would not be a bad thing on some accounts if there could be a law to prevent men from praying, because some would say, we will pray." They would pray. They would get over the shock and stoutly protest, "We are not to be kept down. We must pray." "Ah," they would say, "you can pray in your heart. You need not bend the knee. You can pray in your soul. But it will not do to sell principle or to abide with strict integrity and sterling truth in the smallest degree. Every jot and tittle has intrinsic value." And then he concluded by talking about John Bunyan, who I admire, Pilgrim's Progress, greatly, written 100 years before the American War of Independence. He says, "Look at John Bunyan when they bring him up before the magistrates and tell him he must not preach. 'Never mind, I will preach,' he said. I will preach tomorrow by the help of God. But you'll be put in prison again, they said. Never mind. I'm sorry, the never mind was there. Never mind, I will preach as soon as I get out, he said. But you'll be hanged or kept in prison all your life, they replied. If I lie in prison, he said, till the moss grows upon my eyelids, I can say nothing more than this, that with God's help, I will preach whenever I get a chance. You know, we need to have that attitude. We don't preach because we're in a free country where we can preach. We should preach because we are a free person in God's kingdom who is charged with preaching. And maybe I gave you a false expectation, because I'm concluding with an Ellen White quote. And I think it's powerful, or at least as I understood what she was saying, it affected me mightily. She said, "The power that is near to deliver from physical harm or distress." And that word power, that's interesting. Years ago, when I first started with Liberty Magazine, I went to Texas, and at the airport there in Dallas-Fort Worth, they had a church ministries conference, and religious liberty was one of the aspects. But the main speaker was Charles Bradford, who was once president of the North American Division. Great speaker. And he was talking about the power of the Holy Spirit. It was up high, much higher than this. And there was a microphone sitting in the cradle, and he bellowing out, "I have power, power!" And he got a bit too close to the microphone, and his breath blew the microphone off, and it went right down onto the floor and clattered away. And preachers are usually not easily embarrassed, but I could tell he was literally at a loss for words, because how do you keep speaking? The mic's gone. And I thought this was wonderful. Not that he was embarrassed, but, you know, to illustrate, we talk about the power of the Spirit. You know, not by power, you know, not by man's power, but by my Spirit, the power of God. Well, Jesus said, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you'll move mountains. That's power. It's something palpable, not cheap words. And Ellen White says, "The power that is near to deliver from physical harm or distress." He was talking about Daniel in the lion's den. The power that is near. We have to believe that God is with us. There are, you know, angels all around us. We have power. But then she continues, and this is where the spin really got my attention. She says, "The power that is near to deliver from physical harm or distress is also near to save from the greater evil." What's the greater evil? Making it possible for the servant of God to maintain his integrity under all circumstances and to triumph through divine grace. The real battle is for the mind. It's for our integrity. If we can hold that, God will take care of the rest. We shouldn't worry about, you know, whether we'll get a Sabbath accommodation. If in the workplace you are witnessing powerfully because of your commitment to Christ, 9 times out of 10 the law will give way before you anyhow, and there's other times your witness will be so powerful in the tribunals and so on that it works its way out through the system, that most times they have to recognize that. But it's how we relate to God. We must never make the mistake thinking that our freedom is all reference to the Constitution, good as it may be. I am not to demean the Constitution, but from a matter of history, it's plainly a product of its time. And, you know, many of our people, even within our union directors, you know, they look at the Constitution and they think, as long as we can find its root meaning, we're safe. Well, I mean, maybe, maybe not. But why not look at the root meaning of God's word? If we find what God at root wants of us, we'll always be safe. We need to be delivered from physical harm or distress when we're serving God, but more importantly, kept from the greater evil. May God bless you as we continue with our thoughts on religious liberty. 2 o'clock this afternoon, please, and we'll continue according to our program, singing hymn number 331, O Jesus,